Welcome to Technology and the Arts, a bi-weekly podcast exploring the connections between the worlds of technology and art. In this installment, we'll share some interesting news, websites, and online resources we have come across recently, including Library 2.0 and Timeline website Vigo.com. Plus, we'll discuss the return of vinyl record albums, the latest recording industry rumblings, and a look back at the interesting architectural designs of best product showrooms. We'll talk about all this and more just ahead on Technology and the Arts for Wednesday, January 23rd, 2008. Now here are your hosts, Brian Kelly and John Lemazny.
Thank you for joining us for another edition of the Technology and the Arts podcast. As always, Technology and the Arts seeks to explore the connections between technology and art and to establish a forum for discussing the impact technology has made on the human creative process and on literature, music, and the visual and interactive arts.
And to let you know who we are, my name is Brian Kelly. I'm a journalist by trade, amateur songwriter, musician, and science and technology enthusiast living in central New Jersey.
My name is John Lemazny. I'm a father, artist, student, musician, poet, and technologist living in New Jersey.
John and I are again recording this conversation via call recorder for Skype. We hope the new version of the theme music didn't throw you off too much. It's still the same show, just a new tune. We hope you like it. Anyway, John, it's good talking to you again. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well, Brian. How about yourself?
I'm doing great. What you been up to lately?
Well, classes have just started up again at Rider University. Tonight was the first class. I'm taking two online courses this semester, continuing on the road to my master's in organizational leadership, enjoying that quite a bit. I wanted to mention that there are some presentations coming up for me. Firstly, in April, I'll be doing Trenton Computer Festival, as usual. I am also, in March, going to be giving a presentation to the Brookdale Computer Users Group on open source software. Specifically, we'll be talking about the graphics triumvirate of the GIMP, Inkscape, and Scrivis. And we'll also be talking about open source server technologies. Specifically, we'll be talking about running servers from a USB key. We'll also be talking to the Princeton Public Library, and we'll be talking to them on their Tech Talk Tuesday about using technology in order to lose weight. Of course, those of you who know me know that I lost quite a bit of weight recently, and I want to share with as many people as I can how I did it. Everybody seems to want to know. And these technology talks are going to be a new way for me to start to talk about that topic. How about you, Brian?
Well, I just want to update something I said in the last podcast. I am still playing organ, tambourine, and believe it or not, accordion, with my friend Christian Beach on February 2nd. However, the venue is now Paul's Tavern in Belmar, New Jersey. So don't go to Asbury Park. We won't be there. But once again, it's February 2nd, Paul's Tavern, Christian Beach, and a very talented backing band is joining him, except for me. But everybody else there is like an Asbury Park, you know, music legend almost. So it's pretty daunting to be in this band, but it'll be fun. Anyway,
it sounds like fun.
Yeah, it should be. I just went to rehearsal last week and sounding good, and I got the accordion here with me. I've been practicing.
Oh, cool.
Yeah,
I'll have to hear you do some practicing.
Yeah. Well, maybe in the next recording. anyway, just got through a busy stretch on the social calendar, trying to catch up. I did recently see Howard Jones, like I mentioned in the previous podcast. I went to go see Howard Jones at the Dennis Flyer Memorial Theater on the Blackwood, New Jersey campus of Camden County College. It was just Howard on digital piano and Robin Bolt on acoustic guitar. And it was brilliant. If you want, you can check out the links in the show notes to a couple of YouTube videos that I found that somebody had put up from the show. So, kind of cool. And I bought one of the live CDs he had on sale at the show, and I waited afterwards for Howard to come out and got to meet him. And He signed it for me, unfortunately. My camera batteries died, so I couldn't get a picture of him. And B, he was playing in Pittsburgh the next night, so I didn't even ask about doing a quick interview. So I just let him get on his way. But it was still really cool to shake his hand and get to meet him.
But, Sounds like it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, it was good. But that's about it on my end of things, John. Anything related to technology and the arts you'd like to discuss this week?
Sure. I've come across a couple things that I think are interesting and relatable. One of the things I came across today, just going through my delicious popular tags, was Vigo, V-I-Y-G-O, harder to spell than to say for certain. And what it is it's an implementation of MIT's Timeline API that essentially allows you to, from your own site, pull the back-end timeline structure from an MIT server. And they use it as sort of a front-end for presenting timeline-based information. So, for example, you can log in and put in a whole bunch of your own information on a timeline. And, of course, this goes into the timeline that everybody builds on Vigo.com. So go ahead and check it out. I think it's a really cool application. I love timelines as a way of displaying information. And if you like that sort of a thing, you should check it out, definitely. I have been doing some research on Library 2.0, which is sort of like Web 2.0 technologies that are specifically useful for the library and librarians scene. And so if you, for example, go to Delicious and do a search on the tag Library 2.0, you'll find a lot of interesting ways in which Web 2.0 technologies have really started to infiltrate into service-oriented and information-oriented groups like librarians. I wanted to mention Benelux.com, which is something that me and some of my colleagues are going to be visiting. It's sort of like a, from what I understand, I haven't been there yet. Benelux is a sort of a concept beer tasting place where they also serve sort of tapas and things like crepes and fine beers from around the world. And so I'm really kind of excited about it. Speaking of crepes, on food.yahoo.com, there is some really interesting background and recipes on ways that you can make crepes. Of course, why does this end up on technology and the arts? The technology part is food.yahoo.com, and the art part is the culinary art of making crepes and food making of all sorts. And finally, related to Benelux again, is my continuing quest for hoppy beers. I recently found out in a trip to Triumph in Princeton that I really love the flavor of really hoppy beers. Some examples of some things I've tried recently that I've really enjoyed are Dogfish Head Brewery's 90-Minute IPA. IPA is an acronym that stands for Indian Pale Ale. There's traditionally a lot of hops in Indian Pale Ale for various reasons, which I won't get into here. But I've really fallen in love with these IPA-style beers. There's also Stone Brewery's IPA, Victory Brewery's Hop Wallop and Hop Devil beers. And I just wanted to say that if you really like a nice, rich sort of flavor in your beer, or if you like rich flavors in general, you might want to try out some of these really great hoppy beers that I've fallen in love with recently. How about you, Brian?
Well, John, the first thing I would like to talk about this week is a little blast from the past that was brought to my attention by my friend Katie Musser. And she sent me this instant message asking if I remember best products. And the reason why she had sent me this link is because she had been researching these dead shopping malls on deadmalls.com, which I had actually been obsessed with some time ago. I was looking at all these old, obsolete shopping malls, that most of which have been torn down, some of which are actually still standing as eyesores. But anyway, she asked me about best products, and I replied to her, you know, are you talking about the best stores that had all these, you know, quirky designs? Because that's what I remember as a kid, that the best stores were known for these very artistic, you know, off-the-wall architectural features on their buildings. And that got me, you know, looking on the web for some pictures of these buildings. And it's just amazing when you see these designs and how, you know, you're never going to go to a store again, you know, that looks like these buildings did. I mean, the one in Houston, the best store in Houston, was designed to look like it was falling apart. There was another where an entire corner of the store looked like it had been ripped away, and you walked into this cut out part of the building, and that's where the main entrance was. There was one which had a forest that was in the building. Made to look like it was in the building. It was actually a fake. It was a false front on the building, so the trees would be in between this facade and the actual building itself. But it's just amazing that the best company gave the go-ahead to these incredibly bizarre looking and beautiful buildings. And, you know, you're never going to see Walmart do that, or, you know, any of the big box retailers, you know, are never going to do that. You know, it's just going to all look the same. And it's just, I just wanted to alert our listeners to the site design website, they did the actual design work for the buildings, or at least the first 9 featured showrooms that Best built. And you can look at the project site there by clicking in the show notes. And there's also a online magazine piece that was done about the 9 featured Best stores. So if you want to take a look at that, it's just really remarkable to think that, you know, a retail outlet would design a building like that and bring art to suburbia, which was the mission of the entire project. The other thing, another blast from the past, is an article that was in Time Magazine about the return of vinyl. And a recent CNETnews.com blog post cited the Time Magazine feature story, saying that people, including many teens, are turning to vinyl to escape the grime of digital music. And there's a quote from someone saying that bad sound on an iPod has had an impact on a lot of people going back to vinyl. And then there's another quote saying most things sound better on vinyl, you know, even with the crackles and pops and hisses. And I know Christian Beach, my friend Christian, said that all he's been listening to lately has been on vinyl. So it's just amazing that this old technology is kind of creeping back into the mainstream. And I wish I could say I'm on that vinyl bandwagon. I mean, I would like a new turntable at some point, but I don't know. I'm just a creature of convenience, so give me my MP3s.
Well, I mean, I think we all are. There's a reason that we've all moved to MP3 and given up that high, super high quality of sound. It's because it's just easier to do it. But that doesn't mean that high quality sound goes away permanently. It just means that it's less frequent. But I mean, how many of us, before MP3s were around, were sitting down to anything but cassettes? You know,
right.
It's not, there's CDs, of course, but you're still moving further and further away from vinyl. And yeah, there's a swing back, but I mean, where it really leads us, I think, is to, you know, the live experience, going from MP3 to sitting in a room where you're actually hearing the music. That's where we get reintroduced to the real full sound of the artist's intent.
Yeah, actually, that was another thing that was brought up in the Time Magazine story, was that, you know, kids at colleges are having like listening parties again. People are they're just gathering together and all sharing this experience of listening to a vinyl record playing on a turntable that they can all hear. And it's kind of eliminating that isolation that people have when they put on the earbuds and, you know, turn on their iPods. So there's this social interaction that's going with it, which it's kind of funny. It might actually be this whole social networking thing, kind of like the analog version of it or something, you know, where people are now socially networking through vinyl records. So it's kind of interesting. And staying on the theme of music, I am going to have my first rant against the Recording Industry Association of America in 2008. So, first, blogger Dan Ressinger interviewed a RIAA representative, Kara Duckworth. After reading a press release issued by the RIAA about its file-sharing lawsuit successes in 2007 and its goals for the college download deterrence program in 2008. What Kara told Don won't really make anyone want to run out and buy a I Heart the RIAA t-shirt. Don's main point while questioning Ms. Duckworth was why the recording industry continues to go after small game like these, you know, file shares on peer-to-peer networks while ignoring the huge piracy cartels both in the United States and mostly abroad. Duckworth's reply then proceeded to ignore the cartels again and just basically put out some PR spin. Quote, it was becoming clear that despite cool new legal services and the ongoing educational efforts, too many students, some of music's biggest fans, were getting their music illegally and learning the wrong lessons about stealing and the law. Bringing lawsuits was by no means our first choice, but a necessary step we had to take, unquote. Ressinger asked again why the RIAA prefers to go after the soft targets. In other words, college students, teenagers, young adults, etc. And Duckworth gave the following reply. Quote, college students have reached a stage in life when their music habits are crystallized. She continued, and their appreciation for intellectual property has not yet reached its full development, unquote. I think it's more fair to say that college students don't appreciate being treated like fools by the recording industry. How can the recording industry talk about ongoing educational efforts targeted at students to get them to stop downloading music illegally when the recording industry clearly has such disdain for college students? No education can take place when these conditions exist. The recording industry stupidly managed to hit a new high or new low, however you look at it, when Duckworth said college students, quote, used to be some of music's greatest fans. Unfortunately, that is no longer the case, unquote. So they're stealing music, but they're not fans of music, which that doesn't make any sense at all. The thing is, the students really just aren't fans of the RIAA. They're not fans of being treated like, you know, criminals. And that's all the recording industry sees them as. And it's just ridiculous that they fail to acknowledge that there's a shift in the marketplace and they're just not, they just want to stick to their old school ideals and not step into the future with everybody else.
Let me play devil's advocate here. What would you expect them to do? They're faced with a psychological shift in society that essentially renders one of the most profitable companies in all time to reconsider the status of profitability. It's like if all of a sudden tomorrow you were able to run cars on water. Water is not even a good example. If you were able to run cars on solar power exclusively, you know, somebody came up with some sort of breakthrough in the same way that they came up with a stem cell breakthrough where they didn't need the embryonic stem cells necessarily anymore. The same thing has sort of happened with the RIA. All of a sudden, you don't need them anymore, you know? And so what are they supposed to do? They have this huge infrastructure. They were the reason for all these bands to be popular and exist and so forth. They were fame makers. And now all of a sudden, gone.
I don't have the answers. I sit and talk about it, but I don't have the answers. But I know if everybody in the industry got together and, you know, they really wanted to work together to find answers, they could. And I think that's all I want to see. I would like to see an effort by the music industry, the major labels, to try to find a new way to stay in business. And, you know, I'm not advocating stealing music, not at all. But I think I agree with what Don Ressinger is saying. Like, why does the recording industry go after, you know, the grandmothers out there who happen to have a Kanye West track, you know, sitting in a shared folder on their hard drives instead of, you know, some company in, I don't know, wherever, selling pirated CDs.
They can't go after an 11-year-old.
Well, they have.
I'm saying, though, they can't effectively do that because they can't even enter into a relationship with an 11-year-old in a contractual way. So it's more effective to go after somebody who's at least of legal age to enter a contract. It's there are so many reasons why they've made the actions that they have. The thing that they don't see is why it's not working. If you know why they the human element is causing them a problem,
right.
And you know the I think the problem is they don't realize that the human element is the reason that they are where they are. You know, they need to make a shift to sort of adapt to the way that things have gone, but they're so deep in to the way that they have done things in the past. It's like anything else, you know, a major change, you can either move with it and adapt, or you can be swept aside, and they're in the process of being swept aside. That's exactly what's happening. Look at Radiohead.
Right.
I mean, look at Radiohead, you know. Radiohead makes the RIAA so unnecessary, and they're doing it swiftly.
Yeah. And Madonna, too. And she's leaving her major label. She's leaving Warner's and going to Live Nation, and, you know, she's breaking those chains as well.
I mean, the whole idea of value added, right? Like Radiohead, for example, released the box set for a certain price and said, we'll give you the music, but if you want more, this is what it's going to cost, and this is how you get it. If you want the physical, right?
Right.
The same thing is happening in video games. The same thing is happening in other media. An example of the video game thing is Battlefield is now going to be released for free. And then if you want to upgrade to get your avatar in the game to have certain abilities, you'll do that through paid upgrades. You know, it's one of these things where it's a very open source idea. You can get in on the bottom floor for free, and then if you want to do other things, I mean, it's not exactly open source. It's actually kind of a proprietary way to approach it, but it gets everybody in at a free level to some degree. And then things you want to do on top of that, they may be proprietary, they may be closed, but everybody comes in at a basic level with no cost attached.
All right. Well, there's got to be some answer, and I think if they really wanted to find it, they could, but instead they just want to stick to their old ways, and for some reason, while they're going down, they're going to bring all these, you know, common people who just happen to be sharing files on peer-to-peer networks, they're just going to bring them down with them for some reason, but this doesn't make sense. But then again, this could all be moot because the music industry struggles and recent reports that EMI, which just cut about 2,000 jobs, is considering pulling its funding to groups like the IFPI, the International Federation of the Phonographic Industry, and the RIAA, may wind up resulting in the demise of the RIAA as we know it, according to a recent Ars Technica article. Citing a Variety story in which it was reported that EMI would pull funding for the groups unless major changes were made, Ars Technica has learned that the IFPI has begun internal discussions about efficiency and cutting costs. One of the options on the table is a merger of the IFPI and the RIAA. However, the talks are also looking at ways to better serve the recording industry, and there apparently is some growing concern among the major labels that the RIAA's lawsuits are not serving the industry well at all. Also, EMI's current mantra is that all operations must have function and structure that makes sense, and as it stands now, EMI doesn't see much function and structure that makes sense when it comes to the IFPI and especially the RIAA. So stay tuned. EMI was the first of the major labels to drop DRM. Now all four have dropped it, although EMI was the only one to do so with iTunes. Perhaps EMI can lead the way again and drop the RIAA. Hopefully, the other labels will again fall in line and the industry can start taking a look at real innovation and new business models that make sense, rather than cheap legal tactics and questionable business practices that turn off artists, songwriters, producers, retailers, and of course, the fans. But now it's time for the Technology and the Arts events calendar.
Here is your Technology and the Arts events calendar. Video Stuff, Electronic Gaming Through the Years, takes place at the Orange County Regional History Center in Orlando, Florida, from January 18th through April 13th, 2008. The exhibit marks key developments in arcade games, video consoles, and computer game technology, and illustrates the importance and relevance of these toys. The show explores gaming's history, as well as its cultural and sociological influences, past, present, and future. For exhibit information, visit www.thehistorycenter.org or call 1-800-965-2030. The 621 Gallery in Tallahassee, Florida, presents Connected from February 1st through February 29th, 2008. Artists Matthew Borgen of Philadelphia, Jeff Eisenberg of San Francisco, and Charles Mattson Loom of Minnesota explore the internal relationships between language, science, and history. For more information, visit www.621gallery.org or call 850-224-6163. And coming April 25th through April 28th, 2008, is the 33rd Annual Trenton Computer Festival at the College of New Jersey in Ewing Township, New Jersey. Created in 1976 by Sol Leibis and Alan Katz, the Trenton Computer Festival is the longest-running computer festival of its kind in the world. Professional seminars will be held on Friday, April 25th, with the rest of the weekend featuring an outdoor flea market, an indoor exhibit and sales area, and general speaker sessions. For more information, visit www.tcf-nj.org. To stay informed about these and other events related to technology and the arts, please remember to check out the Technology and the Arts events page at techarts.wordpress.com.
Well, it looks like we're just about at the end of another Technology and the Arts podcast. John, anything you'd like to share with the audience?
Well, as always, I'd like to say to our listeners that if they have an idea for a story or know of a show or event related to technology or art, let us know about it by emailing us at technology.arts@gmail.com. Also, feel free to send an email just to say hi. And you're always welcome to leave a comment on the Technology and the Arts blog at techarts.wordpress.com.
Well, that closes the curtain on another Technology and the Arts podcast. Stay tuned for more news and resources related to technology and the arts when we come back with our next show on Wednesday, February 6th, 2008. Until then, for Technology and the Arts, this is Brian Kelly.
And this is John Lemazny. Take care.
Expressed by the hosts of Technology and the Arts are not necessarily those of guests of the program. Conversely, Thoughts and opinions expressed by guests of Technology and the Arts are not necessarily shared by the hosts. For more information about the podcast you have just heard, please visit Technology and the Arts on the web at techarts.wordpress.com.